I'm Jamila Kremple, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Is Baltimore the greatest city in America, or is it a place to avoid? Often that depends on who's telling the story and your personal experience. You've heard the negative depictions of Baltimore by the media. Does that narrative describe the city you know? And what's at stake if the negative narrative about Baltimore doesn't change? Journalist Lisa Snowden-McCray and Lawrence Lanahan join me. Plus, Live Baltimore Executive Director Annie Milley and Visit Baltimore CEO Al Hutchinson on what they do every day to promote all that's great about Baltimore. We'll take your comments and questions when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, it's Midday. I'm Jamila Kremple, WYPR's digital producer, in for Tom Hall.
Baltimore, 1962. Good, the heyday gone. Of hairdos and hair don'ts.
We shall overcome someday.
Not with that hair, you won't.
Images of children enduring freezing temperatures in Baltimore City classrooms provoked a nationwide outcry and parents demanding a fix.
The victim taken to the hospital where he died. About an hour before that, a man was shot to death in Northwest Baltimore.
Serious allegations of widespread abuse by 8 different police officers in an elite Baltimore gun task force. Prosecutors in trial accusing these officers of being worse than many criminals, planting evidence, stealing drugs, selling drugs.
That was the sound of a few Baltimore-focused stories from Hairspray, local and national reporting, and of course, The Wire. And that's the starting point for our conversation today, about how Baltimore is perceived. Is Baltimore a charm city, or is it the most dangerous city? That depends on a number of things. On the narrative, the stories being told about the city, on who's telling those stories, and what your personal experience is. There's been a lot of talk lately about changing the narrative in Baltimore. Last month, Mayor Catherine Pugh told an audience at the Parkway Theater that Baltimore had a, quote, perception problem, end quote. She also said that the city had a problem with investment and equality and inclusion, and that she wanted to, quote, work on the media not depicting Baltimore always as this negative place to be, end quote. The mayor's statements got lots of people, including me, thinking about how Baltimore is perceived. How do our perceptions affect our reality? Who gets to write the narrative about our city? Do the narratives you hear match the city you know? And what's at stake if the negative depictions of Baltimore don't change? We're going to address all those questions, plus a piece that is often left out of the story, context. I hope you'll call us, email us, and tweet us with your thoughts and questions. A little later in the show, Al Hutchinson, the president and CEO of Visit Baltimore, and Annie Milley, the executive director of Live Baltimore, will join me to talk about Baltimore's narrative going forward. But first, I want to welcome two journalists who've spent a lot of time thinking and writing about the city. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance journalist, and his work has appeared in Al Jazeera, Columbia Journalism Review, and other outlets. He was the creator of WYPR's The Lines Between Us series and was senior producer of the WYPR show Maryland Morning, where we work together. Welcome back, Lawrence.
Thanks for having me, Jamila.
You know your way back here, I hope. And Lisa Snowden-McCray is a longtime Baltimore journalist. She was a writer and associate editor for the Baltimore City Paper, and then editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat, a weekly alternative paper, which it seems came to an end yesterday. More about that in a bit. Do you want to join this conversation? Call us at 410-662-8780, email us at midday@wypr.org, or tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So Lisa, we got word yesterday that after 4 months, the publisher of the Baltimore Beat, Brown, Knapp, Pitts, Omnimedia, which also owns the Washington Blade, was closing the publication due to a lack of advertising revenue. What can you tell us about this decision?
I can start off by saying I'm immensely proud of the work that we did. Like I told everybody it felt like running this paper felt like having a newborn, and I'm super proud of the baby. I think that, you know, all of us did a great job. Maura Callahan, who was our deputy editor, worked her butt off. Like, she worked every day. We would try to tell her to stop. Brandon Soderberg, amazing journalist. did some super important work on the GTTF trial.
The Gun Trace Task Force trial.
And, you know, was only able to do it because he'd started years ago listening to people who weren't listened to. So I have no regrets about that. And I'm happy with what we did. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, there's still so much stories to tell about Baltimore and so much work to be done. And that's why I'm here right now.
Gotcha. In a statement to the Baltimore Sun, publisher Kevin Naff wrote, quote, "Small businesses in Baltimore are suffering due to the crime and perception of crime, especially as it's portrayed on local TV news. We heard from many businesses, restaurants, bars, theaters, and more, that they cut their marketing budgets due to declining revenue, which many attribute to the crime problem and dwindling visits from suburbanites." I'll pose this question to Al Hutchinson, CEO of Visit Baltimore, who's in the later segment, and invite callers to weigh in if you're a small business owner or if you don't live in the city and sort of the perception of the city has dissuaded you from spending time in the city. Certainly, we want to hear from you. But Lisa, what do you say to Naff's claim that Baltimore's perception is, I guess, due in part to why the beat is shutting down?
See, it's really hard for me. Like, for me, the reason why I'm a journalist and the way that my brain goes is to the people who are suffering the most. And, you know, like, I'm good. Like, we're all good. And I think kind of dwelling on that thing takes a lot of time away from the people who are, you know, kids that are in insufficient schools and kids that have homes with lead paint and people who don't have any options in the city. So, you know, to me, it's kind of like, that's such a small thing and such a thing that, for me, my brain automatically goes to those other things. And mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I look at it.
So you're saying you're not so much focused on the negative perception.
Right.
You're focused on the work.
Right.
Which you and the other beat editors and writers have all done tremendous work in the short amount of time that you were given. I understand this is all still new, but there were three editors, right, including yourself?
Yes, it was me. Like I said, Maura Callahan, our deputy editor, and Brandon Soderberg, mm-hmm. who is our managing editor.
Are you guys thinking about collectively or individually what's next for you?
We're all crazy, so... and there's tons of work to do, but no, we haven't really...
Sure.
Started that conversation.
Understood. Lawrence, the HBO series The Wire,
yes,
is at the forefront of most conversations about Baltimore. It's just sort of naturally linked now, even 10 years later after the series ended. You've written about the series. What impact do you think it had on the city?
I think it showed the world some complexity that they hadn't necessarily grasped. I mean, it's become shorthand among civic leaders and elected officials for almost like dirty laundry, kind of, oh, it puts Baltimore in such a bad light. I think people give us too much credit in shaping narrative. We show, well, I mean, the Wire was fiction, but it was very journalistic in its depiction of the city. We show or talk about or print what happened. Mm-hmm. And we do make editorial choices, but we're saying what happened. And I feel like so much of the time when the government comes after the media in terms of the narrative, I mean, we scratch back, and we should, because they're not telling us to show a particular narrative. They're telling us to take something out. They're telling us to look away, and it's our job to look. Mm-hmm. So, you know, The Wire... I mean, David Simon put a lot of work into that. He hired a lot of great writers and journalists and people who were very, very familiar with the city. And he did it in this sort of sociological way that's like, you know, these are the institutions that shape people's lives. And here is what it is like for these people to navigate those institutions. Here's what it's like in this particular place. And, you know, you really gotta... I didn't walk away with, boy, Baltimore's a dump. I walked away with, boy, it's hard to be a teacher in Baltimore. Wow, it's complicated to be a police officer in Baltimore. What, even, man, mayors have difficult decisions to make. I mean, there weren't that many villains, right? I don't think good journalism should have as clear heroes and villains as they have. People are shaped by their times and their places. And so The Wire did a really good job of that. And these people who are saying it puts out a bad narrative or this or that, I mean, you only hear that from people who feel a responsibility to be a booster or who feel beholden to somebody who has an interest, most likely a financial interest, in the perception of this place. Mm.
I haven't watched the series in many, many years. I haven't gone back and watched it, but it seems like a lot of the issues that the series covered, albeit struggling schools or corruption in the police force, those are all things that are still relevant today. Lisa, can you talk a little bit about that? I know, with the Gun Trace Task Force trial, The Beat was covering that a lot, but sort of it just goes to show that these are long-standing issues that are very deep, very complex, and will take a lot of time to unwork.
Right. I think that, Baltimore faces a lot of all the stuff that comes from racism and anti-blackness. So those are things that you can't ignore. You have to talk about them. You have to bring them up. You have to have people that are willing to point out this and say that I'm racist, because sometimes I feel like it's such a backdrop in our country that it's hard to see that it is. I think that a lot of times even very well-intentioned leaders don't understand how racism fuels some of the ways that we govern and the way that we allocate money and the ways that we talk about things. So all of these things are connected. And all of them kind of that's at the base. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Can you imagine an elected official just out of nowhere on TV saying, "Well, yeah, I mean, blackness gets penalized and quarantined, and it's through the enforcement of that we have a lot of our problems. So let's tackle that first." Right. Can you imagine?
It would be amazing and revolutionary.
Yeah. but nobody goes anywhere near that. There's no and the implications of copping to that are so enormous and complicated that what elected official would ever put themselves in that situation,
Well, give us an example. You've studied a lot of these sort of the policies, racist policies that have sort of had an effect on still where we are today. Give us an example of how racism sort of rears its ugly head and impacts Baltimoreans today.
Well, you can go way back. Back in the, 60s and 70s, Baltimore, had public housing, and it had been placed in poor black neighborhoods. Anytime you tried to put it in a white neighborhood, you got so much pushback that elected officials were saying, that's exhausting. We just can't do that, so we're going to leave it where it is. Meantime, Baltimore County had zero public housing, right? And so Bob Embry, who's now the president of the Abel Foundation, back then he was the housing commissioner. I read an article where he's complaining about that there's a one-way street for the poor from the county to the city. There's no way to go back, right? And you had people working at these community action agencies that were started during the war on poverty, where poor families would go to the community action agencies in the county, we can't afford housing. And they'd basically be like, Go to the city. They don't discriminate on where you're applying from, and that plays the one-way street. There's still exclusionary policies. People get very upset if you try to put even apartment buildings, yeah, or low-income apartments, much less public housing, outside the city. Meantime, the city is happy to get any investment. We'll take that. And so you have this funneling effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead, Lisa, before we go to break.
Sure. Lawrence and I, one time that our paths, our kind of journalistic paths have crossed is in Baltimore County when they were trying to basically figure out whether they were going to stop discrimination based on on low-income housing or if you needed housing assistance. And a lot of the kind of grassroots effort to stop that used super coded, super dog whistly language, them and their problems and bringing these things from the city. Mm-hmm. And those are real things that kind of shade the way that we talk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to get to, when we come back from break, sort of the difference in real narratives, people's lived experiences, and sort of the stories that are out there when we come back from a break. But with me now is Lisa Snowden-McCray, who was the editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat, a weekly alternative paper, and before that was associate editor of the Baltimore City Paper. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance reporter. He was the producer of WYPR's The Lines Between Us series and also producer of Maryland Morning. When we come back after a quick break, how do you hear Baltimore being described in the media? What's your perception of the city? Call us at 410-662-8780, email us at midday@wypr.org, or tweet us at @midday_WYPR. We'll be right back.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It's midday. I'm Jamila Kremple, in for Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about activist entrepreneurs and the small businesses spawned by the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. Guest host Rob Savak, Midday's senior producer, will be joined by University of Baltimore professor Joshua Clark Davis, the author of a new book about the rise and fall of activist entrepreneurs, and by Darius Wilmore, co-founder of Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, a socially conscious Baltimore company. Plus, theater critic J. Wynne Russick reviews Gertrude Stein and A Companion at Fells Point Corner Theater. If you're just joining us, we're talking about perceptions of Baltimore. How is the city portrayed by the media? And is the narrative fair? Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance reporter and a former producer here at WYPR for the Lines Between Us series and Maryland Morning. Lisa Snowden-McCray was editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat, a weekly alternative paper. You're welcome to be part of our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780. Email us. We're at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. At @MiddayWYPR is, that's just it. That's the Twitter handle, that and that alone. You can see I'm a radio person. I'm just interested, you know, in the radio. Just kidding.
Tweet us at InstaFace.
Yeah. I want to go to a call. We have two callers on the line. Let's go to Chris in Howard County.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Of course. Thanks for calling.
I'm the executive vice president of the Baltimore Streetcar Museum, and for 20 years I've really been invested in educating just the state, anyone that's willing to show up and ride an old trolley, about just the wonderful history of Baltimore, but to also put it into context about how wonderful the city truly is. And I don't think, I know very few people who are as big a fan of Baltimore as I am. It is a wonderful, amazing, sacred place to me. It's history, it's culture, it's food, it's way of talking, its formstone, its painted screens, its neighborhoods. I could go on and on and on. And so anytime I hear in the media or even people commenting on Facebook about how awful the city is, it makes me cringe, because there's so much truly wonderful things happening in the city. But on the other hand, we cannot ignore that pink elephant in the room of Baltimore, which is the concentrated poverty that has existed here for decades, that we simply do not seem to have a solution to bring people out of these very tragic situations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And until we can accomplish that, all of the glitz and glitter of the harbor and Harbor East and the museums and the culture is going to have that shadow cast over it, and we need to fix that. Because, frankly, for the health of institutions like the one I volunteer for, which is very dear to me, yes, people are afraid to come down. They are afraid when they're coming in from Hartford County. They want to know, well, which road do I have to take? Do I have to come Orleans right. Street, or can I just come up Charles Street?
Yeah, those are really good points, Chris. Thank you so much for calling. And Chris is right. There's plenty of positive things happening in the city. There's plenty of positive stories that our colleagues are covering and that you hear on this station. Just yesterday, something that was really powerful but positive happened, where Baltimore City public school students, not just public school students, I know that there were students from charter schools and some of the other, I guess, non-affiliated schools, walked out in protest of gun violence in their schools. They were calling for gun safety. And that was a story that got picked up by the national media. So there are positive depictions of what's happening in the city. Are there other stories that you know of that sort of give another take of what's happening?
Well, I want to back up a little bit because I really like that comment, and also I want to go to that museum now.
It's awesome.
But I want to think about the one part where the caller said we can't figure out a solution. One of the great things about my job and the people that I get to interact with and talk to are the amazingly smart, talented, sharp activist community in this city. They have answers. We had a resolutions issue that we ran the first of the year. And, you know, people had these great, thoughtful things to say about things that needed to be fixed. And it just feels like there's this disconnect between these people who are mobilized and coming out every day, you know, giving up time from their jobs and their family to show up at City Hall or show up at protests or like the one that we had yesterday. And there's this disconnect between the people in power and these things. It seems like, it feels like sometimes the people in power want to go elsewhere to find solutions, and they're literally here, and they're great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we both, I can assume that you would totally love this city, right?
Yes,
me
yes.
too. And if you were just, if you just sat down with like the last 5 years of the Beat and the City Paper, a lot of that content, if not most of it, is just amazing things happening here and amazing people doing amazing things. All right, mm-hmm. I mean, it may be in the context of solving some really, really difficult problems, but, you know, what the commenter was saying about, you know, there are so many things to love, but we have to deal with the inequality, we have to deal with all these problems. Part of the reason we keep talking about narrative and having a hard time is it is so hard to look at both of those things at once. Mm-hmm. It is so hard to take in both of those things at once. It is still two cities. It is still a place with things to love and things to be outraged about. And how it's reconciling those things. And the people who still live here are the ones who are able to do that. And there are people able to do that. There are people in the poorest neighborhoods and the most segregated neighborhoods who will go on and on and on about how much they love the city. Mm-hmm. Can tell you all kinds of things, even though they are on the business end of so much of the injustice. So, I mean, it is the reconciling of those two things that I think is our job to do. But that everybody, you know, it's just to be nudged to focus on some positive narrative. It's just nuts to me.
Let's talk about how Baltimoreans interact with narratives and what I see as something as a sort of a subversion of narratives. I feel like Baltimoreans are proud, but we also know the way that we were perceived. So we kind of are on the defense because we know what people are going to say. Oftentimes, if I go out of town or even just outside of the city, where do you live? Baltimore City. And then I'm already preparing for like, what are you going to say?
Yeah. I know. You're having a conversation in your head, like,
yeah. How am I not going to take off my earrings and roll my sleeves up?
I had this joke where I'm like, we should all get David Simon's number and we should all have to like text him every, we're like, he's got to field all these questions. David Simon, please help us. Yeah.
Maybe have a hashtag.
Can you make a pretty show?
Right. there are these things, these items or these slogans. I'm thinking of, there's a image, like we reappropriate things like the rat, right? We obviously have a rat problem in the city, but there's t-shirts and mugs that have like this giant looking Godzilla like rat looming over the city. And there are things like a bumper sticker, Baltimore, actually, I like it. There's Baltimore, there's more than murder here. These could be examples of subverting the narrative, which alternative weeklies like City Paper and the Baltimore Beat did very well. Mm-hmm. Lisa, your thoughts on that?
I mean, to me, to hear you say that, like it's kind of it. I think that's even if the people that are not doing these necessarily are, it feels very black to do that, to kind of take stuff that maybe is negative.
Black
and
is
flip
in culturally,
it. Culturally
but not
black.
Okay,
right.
Gotcha.
Like that's great. Like that's how we got everything that's good about this country. So it's like, yes, like I have t-shirts, actually I have t-shirts that have words that I cannot say mm-hmm. on WYPR, but they're, you know, they're just ways to promote and love the city. And that's what we do here. And that's part of the reason why this is an amazing place.
Yeah. And Lawrence, in another way, a pathway of promoting the city was through 2002. There was a campaign, the Believe campaign, that came out of then Mayor Martin O'Malley's administration. People might remember just very simple, a little stark, black and white, the words Believe. They were slapped up on walls and trash cans and all over the place. Every once in a while, I still see, you know, a Believe bumper sticker. Lawrence, were you a believer? Did it work? Did it have an impact on you?
Well, to some degree. I mean, clearly I was cynical about it, even though it was before I was a journalist. But I think compared to the begging for a positive narrative now, it was fascinating. It was so cryptic. I mean, one, you had the way they rolled it out. You just had these billboards. Nobody knew what it meant. They thought it was like the X-Files or something. And then they rolled out this four-minute commercial. I mean, like, you commercials on TV are 30 seconds. This was a four-minute commercial showing – it was – bleaker than The Wire. It was just the darkest. It showed people shooting up. It's this a young boy saying, I can't get away from it. These, you know, they show white guys driving in from the county, like waving at him, like, can I buy drugs from you? And he's like, I'm not a drug dealer, you know. And then he's like, my sister said she's going to the store to get some candy. I wonder what's taking her so long. They show a dead little girl on the street.
My God.
This was the city. The money wasn't from the city. It was from the Baltimore Police Foundation. A lot of, like, corporate
private,
philanthropic giving. Yeah. They didn't pull any punches. Like, this is how bad things are, mostly because of drugs. It didn't really cop to segregation or inequality too much, but it was like, this is how bad it is. And Believe, you get involved. If you are addicted, you know, seek treatment. There's this 1-800 number for everything, you know, sign up to be a mentor or volunteer. And it, like I was saying, where you got to look and see both things at once. It did cop to that. It wasn't like, please hope,
you know,
I feel like that's what they're doing with this narrative stuff, like telling us to make people hopeful or something. I mean, journalists report on the past and the present. Hope is about the future.
Mm.
And I'm not going to dispense hope. I mean,
yeah, personally, yeah, it's not your job.
Personally, I don't touch the stuff, but I know they need a hope dealer. I can hook them up. But really, that's not our job.
Well, and thinking about the past, I want to go to an email and then a caller after this. Robert, hold on. Robert, who lives in the city, we're going to get to you next. But Michael Lester sent us an email saying, I live in the city, and the city has slipped back to where it was when I moved here 20 years ago. People who grew up here but live in the suburbs boasted how boasted how long it had been since they were downtown. O'Malley's election changed that some, as did the drop in crime in most cities, but the 2015 riots erased any positive perception that we were making progress. Suburban natives are again turning their backs on the city. Look at the map of the county. It's defined by what it is not, the cutout in the middle that is the city boundary. Do you have any thoughts on that? About the riots erasing any positive perception. And I have a couple of clips that I want to play after Robert.
So what I'll say is at City Paper, and we continued at the beat, we don't call them the riots. Mm-hmm. We call them the uprising, and that was a conscious effort that we made. To call them a riot ignores, again, I'm going to bring it back to, and I think you've touched on it also, the central issue. If you keep kind of going around all of the central, all of that, the inequality and the racial inequality that's kind of like the city and this country have been founded on, then you ignore a lot about what's going on and why and how you can fix it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. I'm sorry. Robert in Baltimore City. What's your comment or question?
First of all, I want to thank Chris for his call. I think it was absolutely essential to let people know what great resources there are in the city. But I'm a Baltimore City resident for the last close to 40 years, and I come from San Francisco, and I've got to tell you, Baltimore's problem begins with the fact that it has the biggest inferiority complex of any city in America.
Hmm. Why do you think that is?
Well, frankly, at the root of virtually every problem we have is going to be racism. There's no question about that. How can you possibly be positive if you're living in substandard conditions, where you're treated badly, where you don't have honest public officials? If I were black, I would be utterly and completely, thoroughly frustrated by being here. But the fact is, that's life, and we got to live with it, and we got to work towards improving it. But, you know, I got off a plane one time here in Baltimore, flying from Cleveland. And I said, oh, am I glad to be back here in Baltimore. I love this city. And everybody on the plane laughed at me.
Well, that's...
I've chewed somebody out on a train before.
Yeah, we've all had those experiences where we've had to defend our city. And thank you for doing that. Thank you for doing that. You're a true Baltimorean if you've had to come to that. But before we run out of time and have to go to the next break, I want to take us back, Lisa, to the uprising, as some of us called it, or to the riots, as others chose to call it. Next month is the third anniversary of protests that started after Freddie Gray's death in police custody. When Baltimore is written about or discussed, especially nationally, Gray's death and the protests are often associated. I've talked to some advocates that say that's not necessarily a bad thing because it keeps it in people's minds. What do you think of that?
I agree. I think that was a touch point for everyone that, you know, these are things, again, protesters and activists know and have said. And when that happened and put the spotlight on us, it couldn't be ignored anymore. And it also created a way to link it to other places in the country, Ferguson up in New York City, and it made it be not just an anomaly. So,
Images of Baltimoreans who took to the street during that time, we can remember, were played just around the clock. Residents were described as thugs by elected officials and commentators. As I said, there was some difference in how people chose to describe it. I want to listen to an example of how CNN's Aaron Burnett talked about some protesters.
A little impossible here, but at that point, they will take over City Hall until they get those individuals arrested.
We will kill straight up.
Now, Miguel, I don't know how well you can hear me.
Extraordinarily unhappy.
Extraordinarily. I mean, and you have them talking about him being murdered. They're walking by you. They're yelling the F-bomb left, right, and center here to your cameras. I mean, what's the tone? And the anger is very palpable, I will say, right? This is not as calm as people might have expected.
So the video of that clip, which you can't see, and we'll post the link if you'd like to see it, showed CNN reporter Miguel Marquez walking down what he called North Street, not North Avenue, North Street, with residents, mostly black men, who were chanting and shouting things like revolution. There was a guy who said, if they don't give us justice, we will kill. That led into to Aaron Burnett's comments. You probably heard the beginning of that. But Aaron Burnett, it seemed like she was annoyed that her reporter couldn't just do his walk and talk, and that people were demanding, you know, grabbing the microphone or getting in the camera. They wanted to be heard. I want to kind of juxtapose that with last month when the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl. Thousands and thousands of people flooded the streets. Television footage showed police officers in riot gear, a group of young men overturning a car, people standing on top of government vehicles, similar images to what we saw in Baltimore. But let's listen to a clip the morning after the Super Bowl from the local ABC affiliate in Philadelphia.
Some of those celebrations getting rowdy. I don't know what you would expect other than that. But Gio Benitez, he is there. And Gio, these fans were very excited about their first Super Bowl win in Philly.
They were, Michael. Good morning to you. Listen, I got here at 1 a.m. It felt like the party was just getting started here in Philadelphia, okay? But like you said, perhaps some fans got a little too rowdy, okay? We're in front of the Macy's. Check this out. Here, these doors were just completely smashed. These windows here just smashed. You have glass everywhere, okay? I want to go ahead and show you this video right now because the crowds were just massive. Thousands and thousands of people were out here. But, you know, there's another piece of video, and that shows all of the chaos that was happening in some parts of Philadelphia, okay? You had these cars that were set on fire. People were sliding down these poles.
So we can't compare damage between the two cities. We know that there was more damage caused in Baltimore. I wasn't able to find an official number on the amount of damage that was caused in Baltimore. It seemed like, in Philadelphia, it seemed like Philadelphia officials were kind of keeping that number close to the chest. But we did see images like we saw in Baltimore, maybe not on as large of a level, but the words fan and rowdy were used over and over again. Michael Strahan, who used to be a football player turned news anchor, said, what would you expect? Like, boys will be boys. They're excited. Versus in Baltimore, it was things are out of control. This is not what we expected for people to be in the streets after someone was killed. Why aren't they more calm? So, Lisa or Lawrence, open to both of you, speak to this difference in standards and behavior and how those double standards affect how a story is told.
Well, let me tell a story about what I saw in Sandtown the next morning. So I went down there first thing the next morning for Al Jazeera America, and in kind of wandering the neighborhood and getting people's stories, I had heard about a guy who had gotten some videotape of what had gone on the night before and of a car fire by a community farm. And so I went into his living room to interview him, and he's telling me this story about this beautiful story about his neighbors coming together to put this car fire out. Just down the street, hundreds and hundreds of people from all over the region had come in the very next morning to help clean up the neighborhood. And that's just this beautiful story of what the community from the ground up decided needed to be done afterward. And literally behind him on his large screen television was CNN, and it was replaying loops of rioting. I mean, there was rioting during the uprising, and there was video of a looted pharmacy and rioting and this and that, while he's telling the story of what's actually happening, which was something much more beautiful. I don't think CNN would have had quite as many people watching people sweeping glass into a bag.
Lisa, quickly, just before we go to break.
Sure. When that happened, I was writing freelance for the Afro-American here in Baltimore, and I was covering like a community group that was kind of trying to come together post Freddie Gray and kind of figure out some things. And I was talking to this lady. I didn't even end up, we didn't start in this conversation like that, but we ended up, she told me about a gathering that she organized that was just for teenagers to kind of unpack and de-escalate, you know, from all the chaos and stuff that they'd seen. And they said no media. And there were reporters from national media that snuck into that and tried to cover it. And the lady started crying. And that's just stuck with me, because it's like, it just to me shows, you know, not that they're all have come here with ill intent, but like, it's why local media is so important. Like, it's not going to be the same. You're not going to have the same love and care for the community and understanding of the community.
Well, thank you both for your understanding of the community and your reporting on the community. We hope it will continue for many years to come in whatever chapter life takes you. I feel like I'm giving like a motivational speech. Maybe we all need that today. Yes. Lisa Snowden McCray was recently, up until recently, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat, a weekly alternative paper, but that is not the last you will see of her for sure. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance reporter and a former producer here at WYPR of The Lines Between Us and Marilyn Morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamila.
When we return from a quick break, we'll hear about two organizations that promote Baltimore and how they create narratives about the city. Join us. We've got some callers waiting on the line, and maybe we'll be able to get a few more. We'll be right back.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm WYPR's digital producer, Jamila Krempel, and for Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about perceptions of Baltimore. How is the city perceived, both inside and outside of the city, by people who know it well and by people who've never been here before, but have a clear idea of what the place is like because of TV shows like The Wire, and perhaps even more so because of how Charm City is presented and discussed in the news media and elsewhere? Al Hutchinson is here. He is the president and CEO of Visit Baltimore, a nonprofit tourism and travel agency, which is partly funded by the city. Al, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with me here in Studio A is Annie Milley, executive director of Live Baltimore, which promotes city living and is responsible for all of the I Love City Life stickers, including the one I just got, on bumper stickers throughout the city. They work both work on nurturing positive narratives about Charm City and to dispel the negative ones. So let's talk about the city's narrative going forth. And Annie, let me welcome you officially to the
show. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Listeners, of course, may have seen these bright yellow bumper stickers and other things around the city for the I Love City Life campaign. Tell us more about why the campaign was started.
So the I Heart City Life campaign was actually started back in 1998 by a resident of Baltimore. Her name is Carolyn O'Keefe. And she was responding to sort of the same things that we're talking about now, which is a negative perception of the city that she lives in and that she loved. And she wanted to share her passion for city living and to show it off proudly. And so she created a bumper sticker on her own, and she had that printed up. She gave it out to her friends and family, and it sort of spread from there. She later donated the bumper sticker to Live Baltimore as a way for us to champion positivity about city living. And happily, we got it trademarked last year, and we still use it to celebrate city life.
Great. Is an aspect of the campaign to counter message some of the narratives that we were talking about earlier?
I think that's certainly part of it, but really it's about making our residents feel good about themselves. I think, you know, a caller in the last segment mentioned that we're very self-deprecating, and it's nice to be reminded that we do love it here. Many of us have lived here our whole lives. Many of us have newly moved here, but we're proud of the neighborhoods that we live in. We love those neighborhoods, and it's good to be part of a group where you feel like you've got some support, and that's what this does.
Mm-hmm. And Al, Visit Baltimore created a social media campaign, hashtag MyBeMore. I've heard you say that you see yourself as a storyteller. What stories are being told with this hashtag, and what stories are you trying to tell visitors about the city?
Well, thank you very much. Hashtag MyBeMore is a social media campaign. We really call it a movement. In the travel and tourism spaces where we play every day at Visit Baltimore, it's really critical for our local residents, our regional residents in the five surrounding counties to be truly excited about all the great assets the city has to offer. And so this was developed to really create that civic pride, if you will, that we felt there were some lacking in some spaces. So we wanted to get our community excited about everything Baltimore has to offer, from history to the great neighborhoods, to the water, to the port, to the great arts and cultural community here in Baltimore, to the music scene. Baltimore has one of the most special assets of any city in America. And so I think it's really important when you're talking about the travel and tourism space, we want our local residents to be excited about it so they can help us be great cheerleaders. We've done data reporting on this, and research tells us that 54% of our out-of-town visitors that come to Baltimore, they come to visit their family and friends. And so with that data point, it's critical for folks who live here in Baltimore City, in our five surrounding counties, to be excited. So when a family member comes to see them, if a friend comes to visit, they can say, guess what? Go to see these special places in Baltimore, whether it's art and culture, whether it's a museum, it's the waterfront, mm-hmm. it's come here for the academic space. It's mm-hmm. a storytelling. So we wanted to make sure our locals got excited about it.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to a call really quick. Clarence, you've been waiting for quite a while. Can you give us a quick question?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I was a resident in Baltimore until 2001. I've lived in Pennsylvania now. September will be 17 years. I'm giving you the positive.
Mm-hmm.
Still come to Baltimore for church, family, the Meyerhof, the Hippodrome, the roller skating at the Shake and Bake, and the markets.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the positive things, and I love Baltimore because I grew up there. The negative is you still have two Baltimores. You have a black and a white. And as your previous caller said, until the residents and the politicians deal with the haves and the have-nots, April the 4th will be 50 years that the city burned, Martin Luther King died. I was a teenager. The same areas that burned then were the same areas that burned when Freddie Gray died. Well, and my heart hurts to see the school system. I'm a product of Baltimore City Schools. And to see the way the city is turned, it hurts my heart.
Well, thank you so much, Clarence, for your call. Al, what about that? This idea that there are two Baltimores, Dr. Lawrence Brown out of Morgan State, Morgan State University, coined the term and kind of illustrated this on a map that there is a the white L and the black butterfly. That there's two different parts of Baltimore, two Baltimores where development happens and it doesn't happen. How do you balance the reality that many Baltimoreans face with trying to attract visitors and conventions, all things that contribute economically to the city, with the reality that many city residents are facing?
Sure. So Baltimore is my sixth city of doing travel and tourism. And so most urban hubs, cities such as Baltimore, have some similar challenges that we're facing here. And I think from a travel and tourism space, one of the things that we wanted to address when I first came on is to make sure that we wanted to sell the entire city to our visitors as well as to our local residents. The Inner Harbor, as you know, is a gem. It's very, very special. It makes us a very walkable community to our hotels, to some restaurants, and to our convention center. However, the Inner Harbor is not the only story in Baltimore. So we wanted to make sure we created a broader message, and we created a community affairs position and part of our marketing efforts to take the Baltimore message out to our neighborhoods, to tell what's happening in historic Pennsylvania Avenue, what's happening in Pigtown, what's happening in Station North. Those are very important stories for our local residents, but they're also a great story for our visitor, because the new traveler, they want an authentic message. They don't want cookie cutter. They want to know the great coffee shop we have out in Remington, or what's the nice eatery we have in Hamden, or what's the new story going on in Fells Point. So it's very important from a travel space to push the visitor to small businesses. One of the great stories in Baltimore, we have great entrepreneurs here. Mm-hmm. So we should be telling that story about some of those success stories. We have a great makers community here with trees and bags, technology scene. We need to highlight that, because a lot of that is in neighborhoods that a lot of our local folks don't understand. And we want to make sure we promote it and push visitors all over Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about sort of the, of course, the negative press. Annie, has Live Baltimore seen an effect of what some may call bad press on things like home sales in the city?
People ask this question of Live Baltimore a lot, and so it's one that, you know, it's not the first time I'll be addressing it. And starting after the unrest in 2015, we really took a more focused look at this. What I can share is that the housing market in Baltimore City is incredibly strong. We have seen year-over-year, month-over-month growth continuously since 2010, really, but certainly since 2015 as well. And that surprises a lot of people, but truly, if I showed you a graph of home sales or home values or speed of sale in the city, and I asked you to pinpoint for me where there were any incidents that negatively impacted the city, or any, you know, any news articles that came out that weren't positive, you wouldn't be able to show me that in the housing data. And at the same time, we've been adding a considerable number of residential units since 2010. It's about 15,000 units that we've added, and we're not seeing the vacancy rates in the city going up. So there's a strong demand for people to live here. There is a strong interest in investing, making your biggest investment you'll ever make, purchasing a home here in the city. And while that's surprising, the numbers are the numbers, and it doesn't surprise me, because I know that we have incredible homes here. We have incredible, walkable, diverse communities, and it's a great place to live.
And Al, if you could, with 15 seconds left, just give us a quick snapshot of the business community. Are things healthy here, and conventions and things coming into town?
Very healthy. I mean, last year we did about $1.5 billion in fees paid from visitors coming into Baltimore. The city collected about $294 million. From our visitors. So it is a strong economy right now. We need to do better and do more, and that gets to telling the story better and making sure folks know exactly what's happening in this great city.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Allie Milley is Executive Director of Live Baltimore. Al Hutchinson is President and CEO of Visit Baltimore. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about activist entrepreneurs and the small businesses that sparked, that were spawned by the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. Guest host Rob Sivek, Midday's senior producer, will be joined by University of Baltimore professor Josh Clark Davis and Darius Wilmore, co-founder of Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, a socially conscious Baltimore company. Plus, theater critic J1 Russick reviews Gertrude Stein and a Companion at Fells Point Corner Theater. Lunch for our midday guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Stay tuned for Life in the Balance today at 1 and again at 9 p.m. I'm Jamila in for Tom Hall. Thanks to Kathleen Cahill, Luke Spicknell, and Tom Hall for helping me out today. And thanks to you. Have a great day.